Imagine a ship, right? And it's just been anchored in the middle of this endless hurricane for, I don't know, 50 years.
Right, a really long time.
Yeah, and this anchor is just an absolute marvel of engineering. I mean, it holds fast against these crushing waves, and the ship hasn't drifted a single inch into the deadly rocks all around it.
Which sounds like a total success story on paper.
Exactly. But if you actually climb aboard and walk down into the hold, you start to see the grim reality. The hull is just slowly rotting away.
Yeah, taking on water.
Right. And the crew is completely exhausted. The rations are all imported from thousands of miles away at these exorbitant prices. And the lifeboats are literally leaking.
And honestly, the worst part is that no one actually knows how to sail the vessel out of the storm anyway.
Exactly. I mean, the anchor is the only thing keeping them alive, but it has also defined their entire existences merely, not sinking.
Right, which is not the same thing as sailing.
No, not at all. So today, we are looking at one of the most fascinating and complex economic paradoxes in the modern world. We're talking about the Eastern Caribbean dollar.
It really is the ultimate story of diagnostic muddy waters. Because, you look at the macroeconomic surface and everything seems perfectly calm.
Right, the spreadsheet looks great.
Yeah, exactly. But underneath, the structural reality is just incredibly fragile.
And the timing for us digging into this is hyper-specific. Today is July 12, 2026.
Which is a huge milestone.
It is. This week marks the 50th anniversary of the Eastern Caribbean dollar, the EC dollar being officially pegged to the US dollar. That happened on July 7, 1976.
A massive shift for that region.
So what we are doing today is unpacking a deeply ambitious, honestly incredibly dense academic white paper by Dr. Bechara-Sekili. It's titled The Anchor Holds, But What Does It Hold?
Such a great title.
It really frames the whole thing. Our mission for this deep dive is to trace the 50-year history of this monetary miracle and then basically completely tear down our assumptions about what a stable currency actually means for the human beings who use it.
Because Dr. Sarlies isn't just looking at the past. He is laying out this massive structural blueprint for the next 50 years.
Right, transitioning to what he calls a life-coherent financial system.
And if you look at the visual backdrop behind me today, you'll see exactly the metaphor you just opened with. This deep, turbulent oceanic scene, a heavy iron anchor extending into the pitch black depths, holding a vessel in place.
We are going to basically live inside this metaphor today.
We really are. Because the core paradox Dr. Sarli explores is how a region of eight highly vulnerable island nations can maintain a perfectly stable, highly credible currency for half a century, yet continuously struggle with extreme structural economic vulnerabilities.
The anchor is holding securely, but the ship is definitely taking on water. So, to you listening right now, whether you are a finance geek who just loves central banking mechanics, or maybe someone invested in how developing nations survive in a globalized world, or even just insanely curious about how the money in your pocket silently dictates the shape of your society, this deep dive is going to fundamentally rewire how you think about wealth.
It really shifts your entire perspective.
But to understand the sheer gravity of this 50th anniversary, I mean, we have to go backward. We need to look at the forge where this anchor was made.
Right, because this system didn't just, fall out of a coconut tree in 1976.
No, definitely not.
Far from it, actually. It evolved from a very rigid colonial architecture. Like if we rewind to 1950, you have the British Caribbean Currency Board, or the BCCB.
Okay, set the scene for us there.
Well, a currency board in a colonial context is basically a classic imperial monetary order. Currency issuance was entirely separated from democratic economic policy.
The locals had no control.
None. The money used on these islands was tied directly to metropolitan reserves in London, specifically, the British pound.
Which means the local governments on the islands had zero say in their own monetary policy. Like they couldn't just print money to fund a hospital or build a road if they needed to.
Exactly. The discipline was utterly orthodox. The Imperial Center just says you do not manage domestic money. You do not use monetary policy to stimulate your local economy. You simply ensure you have external backing.
Wow, that is strict.
It was. But as the 1950s turned into the 1960s, these territories began moving toward political independence. So the system had to adapt to this new reality of sovereignty.
Right, you can't just keep the old colonial rules.
Exactly. So in 1965, the Eastern Caribbean Currency Authority, or ECCA, was established. This narrowed the management of the currency to a specific group of Eastern Caribbean territories and introduced the actual EC dollar.
But they were still pegged to the British pound, right?
Yeah, they were.
And anyone who knows their economic history knows that being tethered to the British pound of the early to mid-1970s was basically like being tied to a sinking rock.
Oh, it was absolute chaos. I mean, you had the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, rampant inflation, the sterling crises. The pound was just wildly unstable.
So think about that. Imagine being an island nation that imports almost all of its basic necessities, you know, food, fuel, medicine.
Right.
When the currency you are pegged to starts wildly fluctuating, the price of the bread on your local supermarket shelf skyrockets, and it's entirely outside of your control.
It's terrifying for the citizens. So July 7, 1976 arrives.
Yeah.
The monumental shift. They sever the tie to the British pound and peg the EC dollar to the US dollar at a fixed rate of EC $2.70 to US $1.
Which just made a lot more practical sense.
It was a necessary alignment with the region's actual commercial reality.
Mm-hmm.
The US had become their primary partner for trade and tourism. But what is truly crucial to understand here, and what economists constantly marvel at, is that this wasn't just some mathematical adjustment on a central bank's balance sheet. No, it was an act of extreme political restraint.
Okay, let's unpack this. What do you mean by that? Explain the restraint.
Well, to alter that fixed exchange rate requires a formal, unanimous regional decision.
Mm-hmm.
Think about the political reality of being a prime minister of a small, developing island.
Right, you have voters to answer to.
Exactly. Your constituents want jobs, they want infrastructure, they want social safety nets. So the easiest, most seductive thing for a government to do when they run out of tax revenue is to just fire up the printing press.
Just make more money.
Yeah, you devalue your currency a little bit, you print more money, and you pay your local debts. It's an easy out.
But doing that causes massive inflation, and it completely destroys international confidence in your money.
Exactly. So what these eight separate sovereign island jurisdictions did was agreed to subordinate their own unilateral monetary discretion to a common rule.
They basically tied their own hands behind their backs.
They did. They gave up the easiest political escape hatch in existence. And this culminated in 1983 with the formal establishment of the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank, the ECCB.
Okay.
And the ECCB operates as what economists call a quasi-currency board.
Okay, let's pause and pull that term apart. Quasi-currency board. Because if I'm listening to this on my morning commute, that just sounds like deep, inaccessible financial jargon.
Fair enough.
What is the actual physical mechanism of that? Like, how does it actually work day to day for them?
It's actually a very elegant legal trapdoor. Under Article 24 of the ECCB agreement, the central bank has a strict legal floor for how much foreign currency it must hold to back up its own money.
Like a reserve requirement.
Yes. They are required to maintain a 60% backing of currency and demand liabilities. This means for every single EC dollar circulating in the islands, whether it's in a cash register in Antigua or, you know, a bank vault in Grenada, the central bank legally must hold at least 60 cents in external hard currency reserves.
Primarily U.S. dollars, I assume?
Exactly. Primarily U.S. dollars.
But the paper notes a statistic from March 2025 that absolutely stopped me in my tracks. They weren't sitting at the required 60%. They were sitting at a 97.01% backing ratio.
Yes. Almost one-to-one.
I mean, I have to challenge this, though, because on the surface, 97% backing sounds incredibly safe. It sounds great.
It's very secure.
But economically, isn't that just hoarding? It's like taking your entire paycheck and just stuffing it under a mattress instead of investing it in your house or your kid's education.
I see where you're going with this.
Right. If they are sitting on that much foreign reserve, aren't they basically running a pure gold standard just with U.S. dollars instead of gold? Why would a developing region lock up so much potential capital?
You're touching on a very common critique, but you really have to look at the alternative. Dr. Sahilili refers to this currency arrangement as a regional civil commons.
Regional civil commons? What does that mean in practice?
What's fascinating here is that it is an institution collectively governed to secure universally enabling conditions. Look at it this way. No single island in that union could reproduce this level of macroeconomic credibility alone.
Because they're just too small.
Exactly. The sheer cost of running an independent national central bank, managing your own reserves, and defending your own tiny currency from predatory speculative attacks on the global market, it would be completely crushing.
So by pooling their sovereignty, they turned their small scale, which is usually a fatal weakness in global finance, into a fortress.
Yes, they build an indestructible anchor.
Which takes us right back to the central metaphor. Mm. The anchor is the fixed exchange rate, that 97% backing, the absolute confidence that EC$2.70 will always equal one U.S. dollar.
Right, that's the anchor.
And the chain is the legal framework, Article 24, the regional cooperation holding it together. The sea is the chaotic outside world global financial crises, massive hurricanes, supply chain shocks.
The sea is unforgiving.
And the vessel is the actual physical economy of the islands. The people, the businesses, the infrastructure.
Right.
But here is the massive problem, and really the core of Dr. Saheeli's critique. An anchor cannot sail a ship.
Precisely. The anchor doesn't dictate the destination. It just stops the ship from smashing into the reef.
Right.
It stops hyperinflation. It allows for predictable international trade. It lets a foreign investor know exactly what their money will be worth in 10 years.
Which is great for stability.
But if we want to understand why the ship isn't actually moving forward, why the region is still incredibly vulnerable, we have to stop staring at the anchor and start looking at the rot inside the vessel.
And this introduces a massive distinction the paper makes, the illusion of sufficiency.
Yes.
Because just because you have a perfectly stable currency does not mean you have actual economic development.
Dr. Saheeli is very pointed about this. He warns against two symmetrical opposing errors that policymakers constantly fall into. The first is what he calls monetary reductionism.
Monetary reductionism.
Right. This is the flawed, frankly lazy thinking that a stable currency automatically equals social and developmental success.
So it's like the central banker standing at a podium, pointing at that 97% backing ratio and saying, look at the spreadsheet. Everything is perfect. We have achieved economic utopia.
Exactly. Meanwhile, the actual people living on the metaphorical ship are suffering. The hospitals lack supplies, the youth are emigrating because there are no jobs, and the local food supply is virtually non-existent.
But the spreadsheet looks great.
Right, the spreadsheet is flawless. But the second error is just as dangerous. He calls it developmental voluntarism.
Okay, what's that one?
This is the deeply flawed thinking that a government can just boldly fund any socially desirable good while completely ignoring the brutal realities of ecological, fiscal, or foreign exchange constraints.
Oh, I see.
It's the populist politician standing up and saying, we demand a new state-of-the-art hospital, a massive new highway system, and higher public wages immediately, and we'll just figure out where the money comes from later.
Which usually means trying to tamper with the anchor, you know, trying to print money, which leads to inflation, which ultimately destroys the savings of the very people that politician was trying to help.
Exactly. It's a disaster.
So you can't pretend the anchor doesn't exist. But you also can't pretend the anchor is the only thing that matters.
And this dual reality is literally written into the region's founding legal documents.
Yeah.
If you look at Article 4 of the ECCB agreement, it has a dual mandate.
A dual mandate.
Okay. It mandates regulating money and credit to promote monetary stability. That's the anchor. But it also explicitly mandates promoting a sound financial structure conducive to balanced growth and actively promoting economic development.
So the mandate requires both. The stability of the currency is supposed to be the launching pad for developing the real economy, not just an excuse to ignore it.
That's exactly it.
So where is the disconnect? If the money is stable, why isn't it translating into local development? The paper uses the term conversion failure.
Yes, conversion failure.
And I really want to dig into this because a casual observer might think, well, they're small islands, they just don't have any money. But that is factually wrong.
It's completely wrong.
There are massive deposits in this region. The commercial banks are highly liquid. There are pension funds. There are credit unions sitting on huge piles of cash.
The absence of capital is not the problem at all. The problem is a catastrophic lack of institutional capacity to convert those local savings into durable, life-sustaining projects.
Okay, let's ground this. Here's where it gets really interesting, and I want to use an analogy, but I want to make sure it actually tracks with the mechanics you're describing.
Let's hear it.
Let's say the region's financial system is a massive, state-of-the-art restaurant kitchen. The liquidity, all those billions in local deposits and pension funds are the ingredients.
Okay, I follow.
The kitchen is packed to the ceiling with premium flour, vegetables, meats. But the problem isn't just that they are missing recipes for development. It's much worse.
How so?
The health inspectors are speaking a totally different language than the cooks. The ovens require a specific voltage that doesn't even exist on the island. And the wait staff refuses to carry the food to the tables because they are terrified of dropping it.
That is painfully accurate.
So instead of cooking the food they already have in the building, The restaurant management just buys safe, prepackaged takeout from the restaurant next door and serves it to their customers.
That is a much more accurate translation of the friction here. Let's apply your analogy directly to a commercial bank manager in the ECCU.
Okay.
A commercial bank has a strict fiduciary responsibility to its depositors. If a local teacher deposits their life savings into the bank legally must protect that money. They cannot just gamble it.
Right. They can't just throw it at a risky startup.
Now, if that bank manager looks out into the local economy and cannot find a safe, fully vetted, structurally de-risked project to invest in, what do?
They order the takeout.
Exactly. They take that teacher's money and they park it in overseas securities. They buy U.S. Treasury bonds. Or they lend it out locally in the only two ways they absolutely know are mathematically safe.
Mortgages for existing real estate and government debt.
Exactly. Liquidity without a mechanism for transformation just becomes money sitting idle or money fleeing the region entirely.
Which forces us to look under the hood at the actual structural vulnerabilities of this economy. If the credit is only flowing into mortgages and government debt, what does the rest of the economy even look like?
It's heavily skewed.
The numbers in the paper for the end of 2025 are just staggering. Public debt in the ECCU was sitting near 75% of GDP, and the current account deficit was estimated at 10.6% of GDP.
Those are flashing warning signs.
Right. Now, let's not just gloss over that term. What does a 10.6% current account deficit actually mean for a regular citizen walking down the street in St. Kitts or Dominica?
It means the region is hemorrhaging cash. A current account deficit of that size indicates that the country is importing vastly more goods, services, and capital than it is exporting.
Meaning wealth is leaving.
It means that every single day, more wealth is leaving the island to buy basic necessities than is coming in from local production. They have extreme import dependence for the most fundamental pillars of human survival.
Like what?
They import their fuel to run the power plants. They import their food. They import their medicine, their construction equipment, their vehicles.
Everything.
Yeah.
And to pay for all those imports, they rely almost entirely on one single engine tourism.
Yes. And if we cross-reference this with Table 5 from the source material, which breaks down sectoral credit allocation, the dysfunction becomes crystal clear.
Table 5, right.
We talked about the bank manager needing safety. Banks are highly rational institutions. They crave data and familiar collateral. So they pour credit into property, mortgages, and consumer loans.
Why property specifically?
Because a house is a hard asset you can seize if the loan goes bad. It generates predictable data. That data improves the bank's underwriting models. And that successful underwriting attracts even more finance into the real estate sector.
So it is a closed, self-reinforcing loop.
That's exactly.
Meanwhile, the sectors that would actually fix that 10% current account bleed, the people who could actually build resilience are locked out.
Completely locked out.
Like a young agricultural tech firm that wants to build hydroponic farms to replace imported lettuce, starved for credit. A digital services business that could export software instead of importing tourists, starved for credit.
Because they don't fit the model.
Right. The banks look at them and say, you don't have a 20-year history of formal accounting, and you don't own a piece of titled beachfront real estate we can use as collateral, so you don't exist to us.
And this is where Dr. Sacely's analysis is so brilliant. He identifies this not as a moral failure of greedy local bankers, but as an institutional equilibrium that is privately prudent, but collectively disastrous.
Privately prudent, but collectively disastrous. That's a great phrase.
Think about it. The bank manager who denies the loan to the hydroponic farmer and gives it to a foreign condo buyer is doing exactly what their risk model tells them to do. It's a perfectly rational, prudent choice for that single institution. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, when every single bank in the region makes that exact same prudent choice, year after year, you get repeated collective pattern failures.
Right. I want to ground this in reality. Because the result of all those prudent mortgages isn't just a safe bank. The result is rampant land price inflation.
Exactly.
Which means a local nurse who has lived on the island her entire life gets entirely priced out of buying a home in her own community. Because the local bank would rather finance a vacation home for an expat who pays in dollars.
You hit the nail on the head.
You get massive spikes in imported consumer goods, deeply concentrated wealth ownership, and an economy that literally cannot feed itself if the cargo ships stop arriving.
Which brings us to the complexities of foreign direct investment, or FDI. The traditional economic playbook says that developing nations desperately need FDI to grow.
And in the Caribbean, FDI overwhelmingly means massive tourism developments, resorts, cruise terminals, luxury marinas.
The paper discusses this under the concept of the geography of claims and value retention.
And it makes me think of the classic leaky bucket analogy, but we need to go deeper into the mechanics of the leak. Let's trace the actual life cycle of a tourist dollar.
Let's do it.
A tourist decides to spend $5,000 to visit the islands. On paper, GDP just went up by $5,000. Everyone cheers. But where does the water in the bucket actually go?
Let's trace it. That tourist likely paid in advance through a foreign booking agency, which takes a 15% cut. The money stays in Miami.
Okay, leak number one.
They fly on a foreign-owned airline. The fuel for the plane is imported. When they arrive, they stay in a massive resort owned by a Canadian or European trust.
Leak number two.
The materials used to build that resort, the steel, the glass, the beds, were all imported, draining foreign exchange. When the tourist sits down for dinner, they eat a steak imported from Texas, potatoes imported from Idaho, and drink wine imported from France.
So that's just a sieve at this point.
And the resort is managed by an expat management company that repatriates its fees back to London.
Wow. So out of that $5,000 that supposedly boosted the local GDP, what actually stays in the bucket?
Honestly, the wage of the local housekeeper making the bed, the local taxi driver taking them to the airport, and maybe a local utility bill.
That's it.
That's it. The gross revenue is an illusion. The actual value retention, the money that stays and circulates in the local economy to build capacity, is fractional.
That's heartbreaking.
The region acts less like an economy and more like a physical conduit for global capital to briefly pass through before returning to the global north.
But wait, I have to play devil's advocate here.
Go ahead.
If you're a prime minister, a fraction of $5,000 is still better than zero. Is Dr. Saley arguing against foreign investment entirely? Because shutting the door on tourism sounds like a spectacularly fast way to just scuttle the ship entirely.
It would be.
If the bucket is leaking, but it's the only bucket you have, you can't just throw it in the ocean.
I'm glad you brought that up because the paper is incredibly careful to avoid that trap. Dr. Saley does not assign default moral virtue or vice to tourism or to foreign capital.
Okay, so he's not anti-tourism.
No. He isn't saying tourism is evil and local farming is morally superior. He is saying that the structure of the capital flow is what matters.
The structure.
Right. You cannot evaluate a major national project by looking purely at gross revenue or short-term job creation. You have to evaluate the complete life cycle footprint of the foreign exchange.
Meaning you look at the whole picture.
Exactly. When the transaction is entirely complete, what is left behind? Have you built enduring local skills? Have you created a network of local suppliers? Have you generated productive assets?
Or did you just permanently give away a pristine piece of coastal ecology for a few low-wage jobs while the real wealth immediately left the island?
Precisely that.
So the goal isn't to ban the resorts. The goal is to plug the holes in the bucket so that when the water pours in, it actually fills up the local reservoir.
Yes.
But to do that, you need a completely different set of rules for deciding what gets built and what gets funded. You can't just rely on standard commercial risk models.
Not at all.
And this is the absolute pivot point of the white paper. This is where Dr. Saley introduces the 7-part life coherence test.
This is the blueprint for the next 50 years. He introduces a concept called life capacity and life coherent finance.
Okay, define those for us.
Traditional finance asks one question: will this generate a financial return? Life coherent finance asks a much deeper question. Life capacity is the actual biophysical ability of persons, households, communities, and ecosystems to maintain and develop healthy functioning over time.
So it's not just about money.
Exactly. It's about access to clean water, food, shelter, and health. But it also encompasses human agency, the capability to participate in society, to adapt to crises, and to have a voice.
So a life-coherent financial system is one that explicitly protects and enlarges those capacities, and crucially, refuses to transfer intolerable costs onto the environment or onto future generations just to make a quick buck today.
Yes. And to operationalize this, to take it from a nice philosophical idea into hard functional finance, he lays out 7 distinct non-substitutable tests.
Let's get into those.
Every major project, every major deployment of capital must be run through this gauntlet.
Let's not just list these. I want to build a hypothetical project in our minds and run it through all 7 gates to see how rigorous this actually is.
Okay, let's do it.
Let's imagine a foreign developer comes to the island government. They want a massive loan guarantee, backed by the Regional Development Fund, to build a colossal 500-room luxury eco-resort that includes a private desalination water plant. It looks great on a brochure. How does this survive the 7-part test?
Let's run it through. Test number one is life necessity.
Life necessity.
Right. Does this activity improve or does it actively undermine access to essential conditions for life? We are talking about basic food, water, shelter, energy, and health.
So for our hypothetical resort.
For your resort, does their private desalination plant share clean water with the local community that struggles with drought? Or does it draw so much power from the local grid that it causes blackouts for the local hospital? If it undermines the local grid, it fails test one.
Wow, okay. Test number two is capacity. Does the investment build enduring capability, or is it just fueling temporary present consumption?
Exactly.
So for our resort, are they partnering with the local community college to train citizens in high-level hospitality management, engineering, and marine biology? Or are they just importing all their mid to high-level management from Europe and only hiring locals to wash dishes?
Right. They aren't building enduring local capability. It fails test two.
Okay, what's next?
Test number three is distribution. Who actually receives the benefit, the ownership, and the decision-making power? And conversely, who bears the unseen costs and risks?
Oh, that's a big one.
Does this project broaden asset ownership among the local population, perhaps through a community equity stake or cooperative local supply chains?
Or does it just further concentrate wealth into the hands of a foreign trust while the local population bears the risk of the increased traffic and waste management?
Exactly. It has to distribute the benefits fairly.
Test number four is external viability. This goes right back to the leaky bucket. Does this project genuinely earn or conserve foreign exchange over its entire life cycle? Does it reduce the island's external vulnerability?
And that's usually where resorts fail.
Right, because if the resort brings in $10 million in tourist dollars, but they spend $9 million importing the food, the furniture, and the fuel to run it, and then repatriate the final $1 million in profit, the net external viability is zero. It's an illusion of wealth.
Perfectly said. No. Then we have test number five, which is resilience.
Crucial for the Caribbean.
Very. Can the activity and the physical system surrounding it withstand and recover from severe shocks? Can this structure survive a Category 5 hurricane? Is it built at an elevation that anticipates sea level rise?
Or is the developer building it right on the fragile coastline, knowing that when a storm inevitably destroys it in 10 years, they can just declare bankruptcy, collect the insurance, and leave the local government to clean up the debris?
Unfortunately, that happens a lot. So moving on, test number six is regeneration.
Regeneration.
Does the project preserve, or better yet, restore living foundations? Water, soil, coasts, biodiversity. The paper makes a brilliant point here that we often get wrong.
What's up?
Ecological systems like coral reefs and mangrove forests are not just pretty amenities for tourists to look at while they drink a margarita. They are biophysical infrastructure.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a huge mindset shift.
A healthy coral reef breaks wave energy during a storm, protecting the roads and houses behind it. If the construction of this resort requires dredging the reef to make a marina for mega yachts, you aren't just hurting fish.
You are actively destroying the protective infrastructure of the island's economy.
Exactly. And finally, test number seven is democratic accountability.
Are the purpose, the ownership structure, the risks, and the eventual outcomes visible and contestable by the public? Is there open contracting? Is there an independent evaluation?
Crucially, is there a formal protected mechanism for affected local communities to voice grievances if the developer breaks their promises?
Or is the deal signed behind closed doors in a minister's office with a non-disclosure agreement?
Right, which fails test seven immediately.
That is an incredibly high bar. And the paper stresses a rule here that I think is the most radical part of the entire framework.
The non-substitutable part.
Yes. These seven tests are not a weighted index. You don't just add up the scores and pass if you get a 5 out of 7.
That is the defining feature of life coherent finance. There is no mathematical offset for a red line.
Meaning you can't trade one for another.
A developer cannot walk into the central bank and say, look, I know my project is going to permanently destroy an irreplaceable ancient watershed ecosystem. I know it fails the regeneration test. But look at test number four. I'm bringing in $50 million in foreign exchange.
And look at test number two. I'm creating 400 jobs.
Exactly. Can't the jobs offset the dead river?
The answer is no. A dead river cannot be offset by a spreadsheet.
Exactly. The biophysical reality of the island does not care about your financial returns. If you destroy the ecological foundation, the economy eventually collapses, no matter how much cash you temporarily injected into it.
Okay, I have to step in here and push back hard. From an academic perspective, this 7-part framework is stunning. It is morally sound, it is ecologically brilliant, but let's live in the real, brutal world of global capital for a second.
Let's do it.
Capital flows to the path of least resistance. If a foreign investor has $100 million to deploy, and they look at the Eastern Caribbean and they see a 7-part gauntlet of red line tests checking everything from democratic accountability to coral reef health,
I get a ball.
Won't they just laugh, turn around, and take their $100 million to another island nation that doesn't ask so many annoying questions? So what does this all mean? Doesn't this framework run the massive risk of just freezing all development entirely?
You are identifying the exact structural tension that Dr. Saley anticipates. If you simply took this 7-part philosophical checklist, handed it to a mid-level loan officer at a traditional commercial bank, and said, enforce this starting tomorrow, the system would grind to a halt.
Capital would completely freeze.
Yes. The commercial banks do not have the scientific expertise to evaluate coral reef health, nor do they have the mandate to enforce democratic accountability.
They just know how to underwrite a mortgage.
Right. So to make this actually work in the real world without causing a capital flight, you cannot just change the rules. You have to build an entirely new regional institutional architecture.
Okay, so we're talking about a new system.
You need a machine specifically designed to process these complexities, prepare the projects, and de-risk them before they ever ask a private bank or a pension fund for a dime.
Which means we have to stop talking about the philosophy of the vessel and actually talk about the engineering of how to build it. How does this new architecture actually function?
The paper proposes a layered, highly specific architecture, and the foundational absolute bedrock layer of this new system is a regional project preparation and structuring facility.
This is arguably the most important piece of the entire puzzle. Let's unpack why project preparation is so critical. Because right now, how do small island governments actually figure out if a project makes sense?
It's highly fragmented and incredibly wasteful.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, a small island government comes up with an idea, say, transitioning their public buses to electric.
Okay, a good idea.
But they don't have the internal engineering or financial modeling expertise, so they spend millions of dollars hiring external international consultants to run a feasibility study.
Right.
6 months later, another island in the union has the exact same idea, and they hire a different set of consultants to run the exact same expensive feasibility study.
That's just burning money.
By pooling this preparation capacity at a regional level, they gain massive economies of scale.
Okay, I see. It's like building a centralized tech incubator or a venture capital de-risking firm, but for national infrastructure.
That's exactly.
The regional facility creates standardized, scientifically sound templates for recurring project types. They figure out the blueprint for a solar microgrid that can survive a hurricane once, and then they can deploy that blueprint across all 8 islands.
Which saves time and money.
But the paper points out something about this facility that is totally counterintuitive, but completely brilliant. A successful project preparation facility is one that actively and aggressively rejects bad projects early.
This cannot be overstated. Stopping a terrible project before it begins saves immense public value.
How does that play out politically?
Well, in the current political reality, a minister might stand up at a rally and announce a massive new port project to win votes. The project gains political momentum before anyone has actually studied the life cycle costs, the foreign exchange leakage, or the environmental damage.
And once the momentum is there, it's very hard to stop, even when the data shows it's a disaster.
Yeah.
Exactly. But a disciplined, independent preparation facility runs the 7-part test early. If it fails the red lines, the facility kills it in the cradle, preventing the government from wasting millions on a doomed venture.
Okay, so the preparation facility acts as the ultimate filter and translator. Let's say a project, say, a network of resilient hydroponic community farms, passes all 7 tests.
It's a green light.
The facility has modeled the financials, translated the ecological health codes, and structured it perfectly. It is a brilliant, bankable project. Where does the actual money come from to build it?
This is where the paper introduces the Regional Development Finance Platform.
Yes, but we need to put a massive flashing warning sign on what this platform actually is and what it is not. This platform is explicitly non-deposit taking.
Meaning it's not a retail bank. I can't walk in off the street and open a checking account.
Exactly. It is separately capitalized. It acts as a wholesale funder. Its job is to aggregate these perfectly prepared projects, provide co-financing, issue credit guarantees, and then push that de-risked opportunity out through the existing national development institutions, the local credit unions, and the commercial banks.
This is such a smart design choice. You don't need to burn billions of dollars trying to build a brand new network of bank branches across eight islands.
Because they're already there.
Right. The local credit unions and commercial banks already exist. They already know their customers. They have the servicing software. They have the tellers. You don't need to reinvent the wheel.
You just need to connect this new, high-powered engine to the existing wheels. And the paper notes, this works in tandem with existing regional powerhouses like the Arabian Development Bank, the CDB, and the Eastern Caribbean Partial Credit Guarantee Corporation.
The goal is sub-regional origination, complementing the big players, not fighting them for territory.
And this wholesale model solves the exact savings mobilization problem we discussed an hour ago. Remember the local pension fund sitting on millions of dollars, unable to invest locally because they have a fiduciary duty not to gamble pensioners' money on risky, unproven startups.
Right, the restaurant management just buying takeout because they're terrified to cook.
Exactly. You cannot morally or legally coerce a pension fund into buying high-risk equity in a single, unproven solar startup. If the startup fails, the pensioners starve.
But under this new architecture, the Regional Development Finance Platform uses the preparation facility to ensure the solar projects are scientifically solid.
And then what?
Then the platform aggregates, say, 1,000 of these small solar loans from across all eight islands. It packages them together into a single, massive, diversified bond backed by a partial regional guarantee.
It's basically creating an app store of highly curated, completely safe investments. Instead of asking the pension fund to evaluate a single farmer's solar panel, the regional platform hands them a diversified A-rated regional development bond. That is a financial asset the pension fund can actually buy voluntarily, fulfilling their fiduciary duty for safety, while simultaneously unlocking millions of dollars that actually build local resilience.
You match the risk profile of the saver to the risk profile of the investment. It's financial alchemy, but rooted in reality.
It builds a ladder of investable assets. But as beautifully engineered as this sounds, we have to confront the elephant in the room.
Oh, I know exactly what you're going to say.
Because if I'm listening to this and I hear we are setting up a massive centralized regional fund with access to millions of dollars to dole out for development, my immediate cynical thought is corruption.
It's everyone's first thought.
Right. How do you prevent local politicians from using this beautifully engineered platform as a personal slush fund? How do you stop a mayor from demanding that the platform guarantee a loan for his brother-in-law's highly questionable construction company?
It is the ultimate existential threat to this entire white paper. Dr. Sokili calls it capture. Political capture, private capture by wealthy elites, or bureaucratic capture by entrenched officials.
So how do we stop it?
A system this powerful only survives if it is encased in bulletproof governance, utterly strict credit rules, and radical punishing transparency.
Which brings us to the concept of purpose-governed credit. How do we build a fortress around this money so it can't be hijacked?
It starts with an operational mechanism called the two gates. Under this new system, every material loan or guarantee must pass through two entirely separate, distinct gates before a single dollar is moved.
What's gate one?
Gate one is traditional. Can the borrower actually repay this loan under plausible economic conditions? Do the cash flows make sense? This is standard, rigorous commercial underwriting.
Right. You can't just have a good heart. You have to be able to pay the math back.
But passing gate one is no longer enough. Then you hit gate two. What actual capacity or ecological exposure does this specific loan create? This is where the concept of purpose becomes mandatory.
And to clearly define that purpose, the paper introduces a life-coherent investment taxonomy. It's essentially a master classification system for every economic activity on the islands.
It categorizes projects into distinct tiers. You have life-protective and regenerative at the top. Then you have transitional. Then you have neutral. And at the bottom, you have speculative, dependency deepening, and actively harmful.
And we need to clarify how this taxonomy interacts with the two gates. Taxonomy status does not replace underrating.
No, not at all.
If you show up with a project labeled hyper-regenerative organic farming, but your business plan is a disaster and you can't pass gate one, you do not get a loan. You cannot pay debts with good intentions.
Exactly. But the reverse is where the revolution happens. Let's say I'm a wealthy foreign developer. I have $1 million in hard collateral. I easily pass gate one. The bank knows I can repay the loan.
Okay.
But my project involves bulldozing a crucial mangrove forest to build luxury condos that will sit empty for 9 months of the year purely for foreign speculation.
Right, which under the taxonomy is categorized as extractive and dependency deepening.
In that scenario, even with perfect collateral, the regional development platform will refuse to support, guarantee, or wholesale fund your project. You fail gate two.
You might still find some private, unregulated shadow money to build it, but you will not get the support of the regional civil commons. That is a profound paradigm shift.
We are moving from a world where cash is king to a world where purpose is king.
And to measure if this massive shift is actually working for the region over the next 50 years, Dr. Saheli argues that we have to fundamentally destroy our obsession with GDP.
Because GDP just measures how much money is vibrating through the economy, regardless of whether it's building a hospital or cleaning up an oil spill. Both increase GDP.
Right. Instead, he proposes a dual measurement system called the Anchor and Purpose Dashboard.
The dashboard is a brilliant visualization of the dual mandate. Panel A of the dashboard measures the anchor. These are the traditional, vital, macroeconomic indicators.
Like the reserves and debt.
Yes. Are the foreign reserves holding at 97%? Is inflation controlled? Is a public debt manageable? You must maintain the anchor. But panel B measures the purpose.
So that's the human element.
Are citizens gaining essential access to clean water? Is wealth distribution improving? Are the ecological foundations regenerating or degrading? Is the external viability, the foreign exchange balance, improving?
You have to look at both panels simultaneously. If a politician points to panel A and says, look, our reserves are perfect, but panel B shows collapsing fisheries and rising poverty, the dashboard flashes red.
You cannot use a strong reserve position to hide a dying ecosystem.
This raises an important question, though. I want to zero in on a specific category in that taxonomy you mentioned, the transitional status.
Okay, yes.
In the real world, we see massive corporations engaging in corporate greenwashing every single day. An oil company puts a green leaf on their logo, funds one small solar panel, and claims they are transitional while continuing to pump carbon. How does this system prevent bad actors from gaming the taxonomy?
Dr. Saheli is incredibly strict on this vulnerability. Amber, or transitional status in this taxonomy, cannot be a permanent hiding place.
How so?
If a project or a company receives favorable financing under a transitional status, they are put on a ticking clock. The agreement must include a baseline measurement, strictly dated milestones for improvement, and a hard sunset clause.
So they have to actually prove it.
If you claim you are transitioning your fleet to clean energy, you have to prove it every year. If you miss the milestones or if you're lying, you immediately lose the status and the favorable financing that came with it.
But that level of strictness requires brutal enforcement. Which brings us back to fighting capture and political corruption.
The minimum governance safeguards outlined in the paper are intense, and they are non-negotiable. We are talking about mandatory, verified, beneficial ownership disclosure.
Meaning you can't hide behind a shell company. The public must know exactly which human being is profiting from a regional contract.
Exactly. It requires open public contracting, truly independent external audits, and deeply protected whistleblowing mechanisms. The paper makes a statement that should be carved into the wall of every regulatory body on Earth. Transparency without consequences is entirely useless.
I love that, because we see this all the time. A watchdog publishes a scathing 500-page report detailing exact corruption. It makes the news for 2 days, and then absolutely nothing happens. The same people get the next contract.
Governance must be tied to escalating legal responses. It starts with advice and corrective action plans. But it must have the teeth to escalate to restriction of funds, complete debarment from the financial system, and direct legal referral for prosecution.
And what about the politicians themselves?
Furthermore, the governance structure must clearly separate the strategy from the execution. The elected political authorities have the democratic right to set the broad strategy. They decide that the region needs to focus on renewable energy.
But those politicians cannot be allowed anywhere near the selection of individual borrowers or contractors.
The professional boards executing the strategy must be fiercely independent.
Okay, let's pull all the way back. We have talked about the anchor, the 97% backing. We've talked about the leaky bucket, the 7-part test, the project preparation facility, the wholesale funding platform, and the strict governance dashboard.
It's a lot to take in.
It is a staggeringly comprehensive, radical rewiring of the entire macroeconomic and social foundation of 8 sovereign nations. You cannot just pass a law on a Tuesday and expect this to function on Wednesday.
No, it would be a disaster.
If you tried to force every local bank to adopt the 7-part test overnight, the shock to the system would cause an immediate financial panic. Capital would flee, the real estate market would collapse, and the anchor would break.
You are entirely correct, and Dr. Saheeli knows this better than anyone. This is why the final major section of the paper outlines the sequence transition.
The roadmap.
It is a highly specific, painfully careful timeline for how to get from where we are today to this life-coherent future without sinking the ship in the process.
I used an analogy earlier, but I want to refine it. This isn't just changing the engine on an airplane while it's flying. It's changing the engine on an airplane while it's flying through a hurricane. And if you drop a wrench, the life savings of 1 million people are wiped out.
That is a terrifyingly accurate way to put it.
You cannot shut off the power. You have to swap the parts out one by one seamlessly while keeping the plane perfectly level.
That is the exact reality. The transition must happen under load. The deposits of the local citizens must remain absolutely safe. The payment systems for groceries and fuel must continue without a millisecond of interruption.
And what about the reserves?
Dr. Saheeli establishes one absolute, non-negotiable, sacred rule for this entire transition. There is to be absolutely no dipping into the ECCB's foreign reserve assets to fund this development. The anchor is sacred.
You do not gamble the 97% backing ratio to build a solar farm?
Never. The development must be funded through the mobilization of existing idle savings and intelligent external partnerships, not by cannibalizing the central bank's armor.
So how does this timeline actually break down? How do you sequence a revolution? The paper outlines 4 distinct phases over the next couple of decades. Let's walk through them, starting right now in 2026.
The first phase is the foundation, mapped out for 2026 to 2027. This phase is entirely about coordination and rulemaking, not about spending big money.
Okay, so laying the groundwork.
It starts with an ECCU financial transition compact, getting all the political players to agree to the rules of the game. It involves deeply mapping the institutional savings pools.
And this is when you set up that project preparation facility, right?
Yes, and establish those intense, unbending governance standards. It's about building the plumbing and testing for leaks before you turn on the water.
Rules before privileges. You don't get the money until the governance is locked in.
Precisely. Once the foundation is solid, you move to the demonstration phase, running from roughly 2028 to 2030. Here, you finally capitalize the regional development finance platform, but modestly.
You don't dump billions into it.
You run 2 or 3 highly controlled pilot portfolios. Maybe you focus exclusively on energy efficiency retrofits for hospitals, or a specific rollout of hurricane-resilient housing. You test how the guarantees work in the real world.
And you produce the very first institutional investor instruments, those diversified bonds for the pension funds.
And then, crucially, in 2030, you stop and subject the entire mechanism to a brutal independent review.
Because if the pilot programs failed the 7-part test in reality, or if corruption seeped in, you have to fix it before you scale up. Evidence before scale. But let's say the 2030 review is glowing. The governance held, the projects were life coherent, the local capacity was built. Then what?
Then you enter the integration phase from 2031 to 2035. This is where you put the foot on the gas.
Scaling up.
You scale up the successful funding windows. You begin issuing major regional development bonds on the broader capital markets. You start building out massive regional productive commons like shared agricultural logistics networks or sub-regional renewable energy grids.
The system moves from a pilot program into the dominant circulatory system of the region's economy.
And finally, the maturity phase, looking at 2036 and beyond. Deeper regional ownership, the establishment of intergenerational sovereign wealth funds, and an adaptive institutional form that can evolve based on decades of actual hard-won evidence.
The sequencing is a testament to the profound realism of the paper. It takes immense, almost utopian developmental ambition and binds it tightly to strict, unforgiving prudential reality.
It really does. It balances vision with caution beautifully.
What an absolute marathon of a journey this white paper takes us on. Let's pull all the threads together as we close out this deep dive. We started by looking at a profound achievement. The EC dollar anchor has held for exactly 50 years. July 1976 to July 2026.
A century.
Through global financial meltdowns, through devastating hurricanes, through pandemics, 8 small islands maintained a rock-solid currency. That is an undeniable triumph of regional cooperation and political discipline.
It is a monumental achievement. But as Dr. Saley so powerfully argues, stability is only the starting line. It is a necessary condition for survival, but it is not a sufficient condition for flourishing.
The true existential challenge of the next 50 years is building the developmental architecture, repairing and upgrading the vessel itself so that it ensures financial claims are grounded in actual biophysical life capacity.
We need a system where local liquidity doesn't just sit in a vault.
Or inflate the price of beachfront property out of the reach of locals, but is actively transformed into ecological health, community resilience, and broad-based prosperity.
And by using rigorous structural tools like the Project Preparation Facility, the Unbending 7-Part Life Coherence Test, and the Anchor and Purpose Dashboard, the region can finally align its massive financial resources with the actual needs of its people and its ecosystems, without ever risking the stability of the pay that protects them all.
It is a brilliant, challenging, and deeply necessary vision. And it brings me to a final thought for you, the listener. We've spent this time talking about the macroeconomics of the Caribbean, but the core philosophy here applies to every single one of us.
It absolutely does.
Think about your own bank account right now. When you deposit your paycheck, that money doesn't just sit in a vault waiting for you. The bank uses it. It becomes credit. It might be funding a new bakery in your community, or it might be funding the clear cutting of a forest halfway across the world.
It's all connected.
Under Dr. Saheli's framework, what exactly is your money financing today? Is it building life capacity, or is it funding dependency? Is it regenerative, or is it extractive? If your local neighborhood bank had to pass the strip 7-part life coherence test tomorrow morning, would it pass?
Or would it fail on the very first question?
It's an uncomfortable question, but it's the exact question we must demand of the institutions that hold our future. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. Keep questioning the systems that govern our lives. Keep looking past the spreadsheet to find the human reality, and we'll catch you next time.